Hey, you awesome folks. Thanks for taking this journey of discovery with your guide, Keith Haney. You're listening to the Becoming Bridge Builders podcast, your favorite podcast for everything from racial reconciliation to education innovation, justice reform, and leading change in the 21st century. This podcast is for people who love to be challenged with difficult topics, but want practical solutions to solve these challenging issues. Becoming Bridge Builders makes change possible. Each week on the podcast, Keith invites innovative thought leaders to share how they are building bridges in their area of expertise. You will hear breakthrough ideas and concepts that are changing the world. He's featuring guests who are best-selling authors, leaders at Microsoft, entrepreneurs, leading educators, professors, lawyers, and so many more. Listen in to learn how you can be the bridge to the change you are seeking.
My guest today is Urena Zuckerman. Urena was born in Ukraine, raised in the U.S. She's an academic with a background in Middle East, North Africa, and professional expertise in transnational issues, including in particular Russian and Chinese active measures and information warfare, and Gulf state and Iranian influence campaigns. Due to her extensive professional engagement with diverse communities, her language skills and travel experience, she is comfortable in commenting on a wide variety of topics, but mostly focuses on ideological extremism, geopolitics, emerging threats, information warfare, intelligence and counterintelligence, U.S. foreign policy, and regional concerns, ranging from South Caucasus to Southeast Asia. She's also focused on her work on human rights, minority issues in various regions. Welcome, Urena, to the show.
Powered by Riverside.
Well, today we have on our show today, Urena. So good to have you on today. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
I'm glad to have you on. So I'm going to give you a question to kind of warm you up a little bit. What's the best advice you ever received?
The best advice was actually about leadership and dealing with people. Essentially, it's a very common thought that fear is better than love, that you need to intimidate and scare people in order to gain respect. Actually, from a number of people, not just one, I've heard it's exactly the opposite. Collegiality and collaboration and good listening skills and being able to manage different personalities is much more important than simply bullying, threatening, or manipulating people in submission. That's not to say you never need to do those things, but most of the time and with most people, being polite, being civil, being professional works a lot better. And what's more inspiring for people than just simply parading your authority is leading by example and being invested into what you want from others. Essentially, don't ask people to do something you're not willing to do yourself and you're not able to do yourself. That's not to say that you have to be at the vanguard of every project that you're doing. Sometimes you just can't, but you need to demonstrate both the skills and the commitment that you're asking people to sacrifice their time, to put in their efforts, and to prioritize that task, whatever that happens to be, over everything else. And I thought it makes complete sense, but so few people are willing to do that. They substitute position for authority and titles for commitment, for projecting that authority. And you project that authority by being confident about the necessity of what you're trying to do, by being fully aware, believing in what you're doing, and being willing to put up your own sacrifices. And that's how you get buy-in from others.
That's so true. And we need to understand that today bullying people just turns people off. You say, I think we say it here in America sometimes, you get more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. So
I think it's true everywhere. I don't think anybody is particularly fond of bullying. Yes, you can force people into submission if they're in a vulnerable position, if they're afraid of losing their job or their position or whatever it is. They'll do what has to be done, but it's going to be half-hearted, and they may sabotage the project later on, just because they either deliberately or simply because they're not invested in it, other than trying to get paid and not, you know, not suffer negative consequences. So when people do something out of fear, they're not as invested in it. It's as simple as that.
Very, very true. So as our audience gets to know more about you, so tell us something about yourself that most people don't know.
Well, most people probably have no idea that in October 2020, at the height of COVID, I traveled to Libya. And I interviewed Khalifa Haftar while I was there. I got to tour Benghazi. I got to see the former U.S. embassy, or what remained of it, and I got to see the reconstruction and also how life was progressing after the height, the peak of the war, and what was happening. And it was a very meaningful and paradigm shifting experience. You don't really get a sense of a place or a situation until you're actually there. It's not, doesn't mean you can't be informed, but you won't really get what it's like until you're there. And you have to be willing to take risks and be bold and venture out there if you really want to make an impact or really be an effective journalist, lawyer, whatever you're doing, an effective professional means getting out of the comfort zone and being willing to do things that no one else is willing to do.
So what was your greatest revelation from that visit that surprised you?
I was actually really shocked by how well things were being managed, all things considered. Culturally, it's not easy. Middle Eastern and some of the African countries have a very different approach to professional effectiveness than the United States, for instance. So I was very surprised that they really got on top of reconstruction, hired top Italian and other Western firms, and they were managing it without the help of the so-called central government, federal authorities in Tripoli, who, to my surprise, had not even ventured to Benghazi even to look at how things are going, much less to provide assistance. I thought that was remarkable because generally local authorities anywhere in the world rely on central authorities for help, for assistance, for funding, and they just wait until somebody else comes in and tells them what to do. But no, things were progressing very quickly. Things were moving ahead. And there was a great deal of thought being put into how to make the city livable for the population. And it wasn't just about pursuing military trajectories. It wasn't like what I was reading from the media coverage of that area. It was much more integrated with the population and much more reflective of the needs of the people.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So I'm always curious who helped shape the person that you are today. Who are some mentors that influenced your life?
Very early on, my family, in particular, especially in the very early years, my grandfather, who spent a great deal of my time, of his time with me, reading to me, playing chess, teaching me about different countries and cultures, and just talking to me and singing songs in different languages. That to me was really helped me connect a great deal, because he was not just treating me as a child who just needs to go and play and stay out of people's hair, but really engaging. And later on, my parents, my grandmother, they also spent a great deal of time engaging, opening my mind to different experiences and bringing me early on to musical cultural activities, to museums. They did not think that I would have to be bored or that I would behave badly or just not be interested. On the contrary, and the fact that I wasn't expected to be bored or to misbehave made me, you know, curious to see what it was going to be like and to ask questions and to sit there and listen and engage in an experience. And even if I didn't fully understand the way I would do it now, it was still an interesting experience. And that opened me to realizing that you know, you don't have to hold yourself to the lowest possible standard to just get by. That challenging yourself to trying new things is fun. It's an experience. And actually, the types of books that I was reading, they helped shape my values very early on. They helped shape my outlook on a lot of things. And I wish more people had that experience. And of course, later on, I had teachers who really believed in me and pushed me and really helped me with opportunities that I unlikely would have had otherwise. But later on in life, after I graduated school and more towards college, it was less having people directly engage with me, but me trying to learn from everybody, looking at people that I found admirable and not necessarily trying to repeat their experiences, but looking at the values that they put into what they were doing and seeing what can I take away from that to my own life. I never necessarily wanted to model myself after anybody specifically. I very much always wanted to be my own person, but the values and the principles that the people put in, if I respect it, then that alone is something that I want to emulate, not necessarily the professional trajectory or particular experiences, but the character that to me mattered a lot more.
That's great. You have a very interesting background, and I would love to have you tell us your journey, your story of how you went from being born in Ukraine to all the things that you're doing now and experiences you've experienced.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And now a word from one of our sponsors, For Freedom Mobile. If you're using AT&T, Verizon, or T-Mobile, then you're being tracked. Mobile providers collect your location, communications, internet activity, even your financial transaction. They sell that data to anyone willing to pay for it and provide it to the government without a warrant. Switch to For Freedom Mobile, and you won't ever have to worry about big tech or Big Brother tracking you through your mobile phone again. For Freedom Mobile provides secure, unlimited talk, text, and high-speed data for just $29.99 a month, and it includes free internet roaming in over 200 countries. Sign up for the service by visiting forfreedommobile.com and using the promo code BRIDGEBUILDERS to get your first month for only $9.99. See forfreedommobile.com for details, just like the number 4, freedommobile.com.
Well, I came to the United States as a child after fleeing Ukraine at that time with my parents. The situation at the time was very difficult. There was a lot of anti-Semitism. There was a lot of poverty. The situation was extremely challenging, very mismanaged, very uncertain. And we were lucky to be able to leave and start a life somewhere else. And I'm very happy that that experience happened. As a matter of fact, for many years after coming here, I had nightmares about having to go back. And they didn't stop until I did, in fact, go back to Ukraine as an adult in 2016 as part of a delegation and realized how much things have changed on the one hand. On the other hand, being able to connect to people as an adult, being able to see empathy in other people's experience and be able to shift from those early experiences that kind of shaped my early years to being able to see things as an adult from a different perspective. Then that stopped. While I was here, this open-mindedness and that interest in other cultures and in reading and exploring the world and really getting out of my comfort zone was really very much a driving factor, so much so that I very early on knew that I wanted to be in some sort of a career that would have me involved in international issues. And I also was very driven by quest for truth, for helping people get through wrongful experiences when they're accused of doing something they're not doing, or basically get to the bottom of situations that are misrepresented in some ways. I wanted to go into a legal career, initially to fight crime and security issues, and later on it became so much more. It wasn't an easy path, but it was very rewarding. Initially, I thought that I would pursue regular tasks, go to college, study something relevant, go to law school, and then work for some time, either in a big law firm or as a prosecutor, and just follow my career path from there, wherever it would lead me. But things did not turn out that way at all. I graduated law school at a height of an economic crisis, when it was very difficult to get a job. And I ended up venturing out on my own, starting my own practice with no experience, no capital, nothing. It was frightening, almost paralyzing at times. But eventually, after doing these things for a few years, I realized I had an opportunity to engage as a human rights lawyer to assist people in need. It was a voluntary experience. I was not getting paid for that. But that put me on a trajectory to where I am today, and I learned a great deal. And it completely shifted my mindset. It forced me to become a completely different person, to leave the comfort of illusions and paradigms and stereotypes and myths that motivated me initially, and start dealing with the reality. If I want to really help people, then I have to look at the real way I can help them and not what feels good. Because sometimes helping people doesn't feel good. Sometimes it's painful, sometimes it's heartbreaking, and sometimes it puts you at a disadvantage professionally and otherwise, and takes a toll on your health, on your mental state, on everything that you're doing. It becomes if you want to become really good at what you do and very successful at what you do, then you have to be willing to sacrifice everything, and even more than that. And that was a long, long process, but it motivated me to really try new things, new directions, because a lot of the times, if you're out there on your own, you're not going to have the institutional support and assistance. You're going to have more obstacles than somebody who is embedded in some institution or think tank or NGO. And you're going to be going against everyone that you know and everything that you yourself have been taught to believe and think. But it shapes you. It gives you tools to fight through obstacles, to fight through these challenges, to find ways around them, and to think differently, to be more connected, to have a more interdisciplinary mindset, to look for creative ways of interpreting information and finding solutions. And it helps you grow professionally, and you get confidence. Surprisingly, you get confidence by doing that, because there's no one to give you direction, and you have to figure out. And once you solve something, you can go back to that at the height of your own insecurity and say, well, I've managed to get through that on my own, so I can get over that next thing.
Sure. You mentioned something I want to talk about. You mentioned human rights and how you got involved. You started out getting involved in that. And I'm thinking about what we're seeing happening now, going back to your home country of Ukraine. And I think what gets lost in the Russia-Ukraine conflict are the human rights issues. Can you maybe speak a little bit about what your perception of what's going on with human rights in Ukraine right now?
I'd say it's one of the biggest humanitarian crises in the world. Millions of people have fled the country, and they've had to go someplace, and many of them settled in nearby countries like Poland, which is a heavy economic and social toll. And a lot of these people are motivated, they're educated, they want to work, but nevertheless, leaving your home in the middle of a crisis, having to abandon your family, your friends, everything you know, it's hard. And I think people are underestimating it. I think Ukraine has turned into a political football for various interests. And this human factor, I was shocked to hear some of the people I used to respect a great deal engage in completely dehumanizing, generalizing rhetoric. All those people are all X, Y, and Z. They're all corrupt, anti-Semitic, Nazi, whatever. And I said, how can you possibly say that about millions of people, even if you don't like the culture, even if you think that the country has had a lot of these influences? But these are human beings. Some of them are children growing up. They have nothing to do with politics ideology, corruption. And frankly, precisely because the situation is so complicated politically, you should have more compassion for people who are stuck in that situation with no hope. And, you know, people have started projecting domestic political issues on a massive human rights situations where people are suffering, where there's butchery on the streets, where people are being massacred with no way to defend themselves, where children are being abducted. Hundreds of thousands of civilians, including many children, have been abducted out of Ukraine and nowhere to be found, and nobody knows where they are right now. This is shocking. This is, I would say, probably a top crisis since World War II in some ways in the West. Not in other areas of the world. There's been horrific massacres in China and elsewhere around the world, but in the West, it's probably the biggest humanitarian crisis, and it's a biggest human rights disaster in terms of sheer numbers of people affected. We've had a horrific genocide in former Yugoslavia. It was awful, but the scale of what we're seeing here, I think, is may become worse if the crisis expands. But the sheer number of people who had to leave, the millions of jobs affected, and how what impact it has had on the rest of Europe and elsewhere around the world. Because it's also not just about Ukrainian civilians, but people in developing countries that are suffering as a result of food crisis. The poorest countries, such as Yemen, such as Afghanistan, such as Egypt with a huge population, have been affected heavily by the food-related disruptions. And if you're already starving, like Afghanistan has a humanitarian disaster of its own, but if you lose your access to humanitarian supplies, it's devastating. And this toll has been extremely broad, and no one is really talking about it other than in very broad generalities.
And I noticed that, you know, you made something, I made a good point here, that people have turned this into a political football. And what gets lost, and you said it very well, is the human aspect of this. We've turned it into a Russia-Ukraine border war, but we just ignore the human suffering that is being impacted by the people of Ukraine. So if you're sending a message out to Americans who are just kind of sick of the Ukraine story, what would you kind of remind them of as they hear the story about Ukraine?
The one thing I've always been proud about of living in the U.S., being an American, is the generosity of regular people. Forget governments and what they do. Don't do governments and governments. But U.S. is the most charitable country in the world. It may not be the wealthiest people per capita, but it is the most charitable. And I would like people to stop listening to propaganda on the news, forget what they hear, what they read, forget about the politicians, and look at the people and the suffering of the regular people, of the children, of the innocent civilians who are caught in the middle of it and who didn't choose it. They don't want to be in a war. They don't want to be dependent on somebody else's donations and charity. They don't have a choice because they didn't choose this. They don't want to be dependent on anybody, but they want to move on with their lives and they want to be, you know, be happy and productive. So don't think about somebody else's agenda. Think about how you can really help people to get back to where they can live with dignity, because they didn't ask for this disaster and they don't want, they would rather not have your help. But if you ignore them, it will only get worse. And if you were in that situation, you would want somebody to help you get back on your feet. Don't think of it as a charity. Think of it as an investment into a better future, into a future where people can overcome whatever biases, whatever bigotry, whatever issues. But they cannot do that if the situation keeps getting worse, if they're being killed. Think about lives of innocent individual people who have choices, who want to pursue a better life, who want to pursue better choices, who want to make their country better, who want to make the world better. They're not all, you know, evil politicians, corrupt politicians. They're most of the people have nothing to do with that, have no impact on politics whatsoever, and they just want to contribute just as you are. They are not no different from you and me.
Right. As we're taping this, not only is the Ukraine issue becoming, you know, it is still on the forefront of our minds, but now we see China is moving in toward Taiwan and threatening the people of Taiwan. And we haven't talked about the Chinese human rights crisis, but that's also a part of this bigger picture. So how does the U.S. try and balance its foreign policy with the human rights issues in a geopolitical way? Because there's a lot of pain and suffering in the world right now.
I mean, I think lately, especially, there's been a huge disconnect between Congress and administrations, with Congress taking initiatives on human rights issues, pushing for sanctions. The administrations have tried to isolate specific individuals, but overall, I would say issues such as climate change, energy cooperation, and general preserving general stability have taken front and center over any other considerations, and that includes an acknowledged genocide of Uyghurs in China. And by the way, preceding this horrific atrocity, there's been horrific massacres of other types of civilians. There's been re-education camps where people go and just disappear, of political prisoners with the objections to the official ideology. There's been a horrific cultural genocide of in Tibet, destruction of religious freedom there, and later also religious oppression of Christianity, of Christians and other minorities in China. So it's been a very broad issue, and it's more than just one genocide. It's a horrific system, completely dehumanizing two people. And I think the problem is people basically tend to see it as we can't force China to change its entire system because you have over a billion of people who are buying into it and who are part of official institutions, and we can't sanction everybody, or because quite frankly, there are too many people to sanction. And there's also a concern that if we freeze all their funding of all these officials, that there's going to be a financial blowback against U.S. economy. That's the consideration. Unfortunately, I don't think this is a very good way of thinking about it, because we are not unaffected by these human rights abuses. And these are millions of people that we should be thinking of as our allies who could be helpful to us against the security threats and economic threats facing us as a result of this situation. We can't, you know, U.S. is struggling with trying to contain China's influence in the region and its interference with matters in the U.S. and in Europe and its military threat. But in reality, the biggest challenge to China are its own citizens. And had we been, if we prioritize their well-being, if we prioritize good relations, if we prioritize exposing the human rights abuses, we can see what is happening in Iran, challenging similar types of civil unrest and opposition to this oppression, challenging China. And we have seen some of that recently at the height of the COVID lockdowns in China. There's been massive protests by people who are tired of the system, tired of being dehumanized, tired of this surveillance. That they've exchanged their freedom for economic stability, but they're losing even that now. And there's only so much people can tolerate. So this was an opportunity for the U.S. to use the human rights situation for something greater, to accomplish something, to create this path to a long-lasting change and a shift, and to empower the people of China to address this threat and make it less of a burden on us, quite frankly. But unfortunately, that's not the mindset. I don't think people understand the connection between these human rights situations and security and economic interests. And yeah, frankly, even the security interests are being prioritized before these economic and climate change or whatever concerns.
Yeah, I saw the protests when they were calling for Xi Jinping to step down as a ruler. And I wonder how, because it seems to me like part of the uncoupling of the U.S. and the China relations is our U.S. corporations. They are so tied into the Chinese economy. How do we get the help of our U.S. corporations to help with our human rights and our foreign policy issues so that we can maybe uncouple from what China, the connection with China and the U.S. economy?
Well, to some extent, it's in the business interests of these corporations to disengage from situations that are, quite frankly, a business risk. And China is an increasingly volatile state. Its economy is not as strong as people believe that it is. It still has a huge consumer base, but due to increasingly insular decision making by the state, people are actually losing a great deal of money. So their consumer capacity is falling, and that means instability, economics instability, and political decision making by the top echelons means that foreign businesses and foreign investments are at risk. They can be kicked out or nationalized at any moment. And we have seen this happen in Russia. We have seen that happen in Iran. I realize that people just want to make money anywhere, but they need to think long-term about their own interests. And there are other opportunities that are rising in India, which needs a great deal of help, by the way, to grow. And U.S. has the know-how to help them get there. So if these companies want to make money, they can go to developing countries that are on the rise, that have a lot of problems, sure, but, you know, being nationalizing, you know, foreign investments or kicking out foreign companies for no reason is not one of them. And there are other countries in the region that, you know, that frankly have better climate for business than China does. So engaging in self-interest is one thing. Pressuring them, sure, as a national security measure in certain sectors, it's a necessity. If the companies are helping China develop its military or communications or capabilities that could be used against the United States, they have no business doing that at all. And they need to be compelled to withdraw as a national security measure in those instances. Fortunately, we are seeing some of the companies starting to rethink their positions. Even Apple is talking of withdrawing voluntarily because they have seen what China is doing. They are not going to be kind to these companies. They're going to take whatever they can from them, steal whatever they can from them, and then in the best case scenario, leave them out in the cold, or in worst case scenario, some of these people may end up being, you know, political hostages, and their property will be completely will be confiscated and utilized by China to develop competitive products, which has been done before and is likely to happen again. So big tech, I would say, is at the forefront of the companies that are run that risk. Textile and those sorts of products, they're not necessarily a national security threat. We do need to have, you know, to prevent future supply chain disruptions by having a domestic industry or industry close to home and not in a hostile state and having diversified options. But in terms of big tech, they are the ones most at risk helping China with security and military systems that can harm U.S. and can harm the rest of the world. And U.S. is doing the right thing right now by denying semiconductor industry to China, but it's only a matter of time before China develops its own domestic consumption. So we have to be thinking aggressively and giving these companies opportunities to help us against China and to develop competitive products against China and bring them back to things that we need. Give them opportunities to do the right thing. We need to be far more aggressive about this business competition. And I think we've let go of that. We've let other considerations drive innovation out of our borders. And in private industry, we're still pretty good as far as military government developments is concerned, but that's not everything. We need competitive commercial markets that can offer that edge over China and over anyone else who is who can use technology against us. And we need to incentivize that. We need to prioritize that. We need to tell them you can make more money here with less risk.
Yeah, I noticed just recently that the pharmaceutical industry was hit hard, especially baby aspirin, because so much of that is made in China. And you talked about the supply chain problem, that if we don't bring those pharmaceuticals back over here, we're going to have shortages that could really impact the health of America.
COVID was certainly brought a lot of that to light with the masks, which were not being made in the U.S. And there were other countries that were making them, but we didn't have contracts with them. And it was a complete mess. And I understand that outsourcing production to cheaper countries makes sense from a business standpoint. But at the very least, we should have had supplies and we should have planned ahead in terms of stocking up on supplies, even if they're made somewhere else. And certainly not investing all of our critical productions in one country, any one country, no matter how friendly or reliable, something can happen. Not necessarily politically, but they can have a crisis of their own and simply not be able to manage that. So it's just not very smart not to have this sort of critical force majeure considerations in terms of critical products, whatever they happen to be. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that baby formula should be made in China at all. We've had cases where baby formula has been deliberately sabotaged by China, and there's been deaths. That is, you know, with a country that does not value human life and values income or dependency or political considerations about human life, you cannot depend for them on them on such products. It's ridiculous. And again, these things can be very simply made in the U.S. and we should be finding better economic pathways to incentivize people to want to stay here. I think at this point, people have probably figured out that confiscating all wealth from billionaires is not going to help, you know, the poor people. You know, the poor people. It's, you know, that money along the way that's supposed to help the poor people is going to get lost in the bureaucracy, just, you know, mismanaged. So if you want to help poor people, empower them. Don't just think about how you can take something else from somewhere else. Think about how you can give them useful skills and useful paths to build up their own wealth. So our entire economic approach has been completely mismanaged, which has led to these problems such as supply chain issues. Unfortunately, while COVID was one big crisis, which is, you know, on its way to being resolved, there can be more future crises in the future. If countries like China see that we have not really learned the lesson from what may have been, you know, an incidental disaster, in the future, these disasters can be, for sure, can be, you know, created artificially in various ways, not just through illnesses, but or outbreaks or whatever. So we don't want that to happen. We don't want our vulnerabilities, our critical economic, logistical weaknesses to be taken advantage of. We need to be building resilient economies and resilient critical infrastructure that can withstand crisis. And we need to have options, diverse options that we can turn to if something doesn't work out. Plan A, B, C, D, and whatever.
That's great. So I'd like to get my audience. We talked about a lot today. But for the average American listening to the podcast, give us one thing they can do to help. You talked about the people of Ukraine first, but just help our country understand more about how we can impact human rights around the world.
I think the best thing any person can do is, first of all, start by educating themselves on whatever they feel compelled to. No person can follow every issue or spend their entire time just, you know, wading through mountains of information from different sources. That's understandable. Choose something that is meaningful to you. It may or may be not be related to your own life. Think of your own skill sets. How can you apply what you already have or what you're willing to learn in small ways? You don't have to try to solve global crisis individually, but if you can help one person somewhere in one way, if you can provide a job for somebody, if you can provide skills training, if you can provide a connection, a contact that can help bring them to safety, if you can provide legal advice, exposure to their stories, and accurate information. Most be aware of all the junk that's out there, the propaganda, the disinformation from many sites. Be critically minded. Yes, you can't wade through all of it, but once you start asking yourself basic questions, who benefits? Why would they create a story? Why would a story like that be covered in that way? Who is harmed? What happens, you know, as a result of this coverage? Then a lot of the stuff starts to fall apart on its own, and you start seeing everything in a different light. One story becomes every story, and then you know what to listen to and how to discern. So ask basic questions, be critical, listen careful to people when they talk to you. Don't assume based on what you think you already know and what your circles are telling you. With Ukraine, there are wonderful humanitarian organizations that you can help. You don't trust the government to provide the aid that it needs. And quite frankly, you know, governments are mostly concerned with military operations. You don't need to be concerned about that. But if you can help people through donations, and it doesn't need to be financial, it could be products that are in short supply. You know that some of these things are going to go to regular civilians. Some of the stuff is not really so expensive that people will make millions of dollars from that. Go to trusted sources. Go to people you know and trust to help them. If you are talking about information, listen to human stories. Forget about the politics. Just let people tell their story. It means a lot to them. And see how you can connect them to the resources that can help them provide shelter, provide basic human needs. That's the best thing you can do.
That's great. So I want to, as we wrap this up, I want to ask you a question. As we wrap up, I ask all my podcast guests this question. What do you want your legacy to be?
Quite frankly, I don't really think, I'm not a politician. I don't think about my legacy. I do think that in the future when I have children, what do I want to learn from me? And I want, what values and principles I want to pass on to them? How do they want me to see what's important to life when so much is I won't say consumerism, you know, there's nothing wrong with living well and wanting to live well. But the fact that you can get to where you want through different means, and you don't have to take shortcuts and cause problems for other people without a reason, just to get to where you want to be. I want them to be inspired to pursue sometimes more difficult directions that are more rewarding, that will get them to better places and to put value into individual human lives, into connections with people, because that's your greatest resource. And whoever is watching that, I want to show them that it's possible to maintain your integrity, to maintain basic sense of decency towards other people and still succeed by any definition, financially, in terms of reaching your goals, your agendas, status, fame, whatever you want, you can get there without as being part of a solution to problems, not being part of the problems, not contributing to disinformation or destroying people's lives and reputations and being part of a mob. You can be your own person. It may be more difficult, it may be more challenging, but at the end of the day, you can be just as, if not more successful, because at the end of the day, people who take shortcuts, who disregard ethics, they get caught in their own problems. And the very people who helped them before, people who are unethical, that they turn to for help, become their worst enemies. So don't do that. Think about what can you do to make your own life meaningful? What can you do to provide something that's worth doing, that helps you live in a better world? You know, don't start thinking about how you can help the entire world, because then you become this idealist that doesn't end up pursuing very shallow and superficial causes with very little to show for it. But what makes your own life meaningful, what you want people to get out of it, how you can build up a better community where everyone, including yourself, are happier, live meaningful, productive lives. If something moves you, how can you make it happen? What practical pathway can you do to improve that particular situation? If you can, great. If you can't, then how can you contribute otherwise? I think my legacy in terms of what I want to leave behind is setting the example of being dedicated to the values that I hold dear, truthfulness, being a just person, being a person who values human beings, who values individuals, who doesn't judge them by some on the basis of stereotypes, who takes the time to listen to them, to hear them, and who approaches everything she does with dedication, with commitment, and comes from a right place, not just out of greed, not just out of ambition, though ambition, there's nothing wrong with it, but you also think, how can I do this? How can I accomplish my ambition in the right way?
That's great. I love that. So where can people find you on social media?
Well, the good news is I have a lot more time on my hands to do productive things now that I've been banned to Twitter things from Twitter, thanks to my dedication. It's been a kind of a wild ride. It happened in late July. Tomorrow I'll be celebrating a 5-month anniversary of being banned from Twitter.
Oh my!
all because I aired an interview people did not want me to air, raising questions that people didn't want asked. So there was a kind of a mob reaction, mass reporting, and I haven't been able to get through to anybody about even responding to why I was banned exactly. Private anonymous accounts claim I was disseminating disinformation, but asking questions about things people find uncomfortable is not disinformation. It's my job as a journalist, as a lawyer.
Sure.
Yeah, but but other than that, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook, I'm on YouTube. I have my own show, the Washington Outsider Report, on the Coalition Radio, where you can find me, and as well as my own website, the Washington Outsider, where I publish articles, also share my own panel discussions with the speakers on various topics. So and of course I publish in different publications and on different topics, and I'm also engaged a lot as an expert in various areas. So I'm quoted as well as I write and speak out on my own as well.
Well, good. I hope you get back on soon, because I know they're letting some people back on Twitter. So maybe your ban will be lifted and you'll be able to share again your content with the world.
For sure. Fingers crossed. But if not, you know, I will continue to stay engaged in other ways. And hopefully, by being persistent, by being productive, my voice will be heard.
Well, thank you so much. Blessings on what you do, and continue to share that message with the world, because we desperately need to hear what's going on besides in our own little corner of the world.
Thank you so much. And thank you for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
You have a great new year.
You too.
Thanks for listening to Becoming Bridge Builder. If you enjoyed this episode and want to help support the podcast, please subscribe and share it with others. Post about it on social media or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Instagram @BKeithHaney and on Getter and Twitter @RevHedpin or on his website at alightbreakthrough.org. Thanks again, and tune in next time.